listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hollywood. This is your host with the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right in this interview. We have a very special guest, one of my favorite people on the planet, Mr. Marty Rifkin. How are you, Marty?
I'm good, Nikki. How are you?
Good to see you again, even if it's virtual, you know?
I'll take it.
Real quick, I see you got some gold and platinum records up on your wall. Just rattle off some of those. I know you've been playing pedal steel for a long time, but I'm just curious to see what records are on the wall.
Ooh, I should look. A couple of Bruce Springsteen things. Jewel, Tom Petty. I guess the actual albums. Weird Al.
That's awesome.
So
awesome. I'm sure you have so many. You're like, oh well, I can't put them everywhere. You know.
Well, no. I mean, there's a few, but. You know, we're not in it for that, but I'll take them.
So as I know, and you know, you came to Los Angeles as a bass player and you started, you know, kind of playing bass and going to sessions and then realizing I'm going to make a pivot. Tell me before you started playing bass, what was that moment of Zen that kind of made you want to become a musician and kind of fall in love with music?
Well, I had a friend, Cliff Perlow. He was, you know, we were like 14 and he had a little band with his brother and a drummer, and his brother was a couple years older and played football in school and all and wanted to do that. He had played bass. So Cliff was like, hey, learn this. And I took it home, and I remember the first night I learned Hey Joe, you know, that bass part, you know, do. And I did it with one finger on two strings. But I knew I could do it somehow. I mean, I had no idea I would be able to. And I'm sure it wasn't good, but it was, you know, good enough for me to think that I could do it. And at that point, everything just clicked. I just lived with an instrument in my hand like that.
How old were you when you kind of discovered
I want to say 14, probably. Wow. Well, maybe 13. Nah, I think 14. Maybe 15.
I love that you started with Hendrix. Like that, what a great, great way to start with music. You know, like, were you like rehearsing that song to be in a band, or what was the?
Well, that was a song that they did in the band, I guess. And I don't know how I ended up knowing what those notes were. Maybe his brother told me. I'm not sure. I don't recall that. I just remember it was like an old knockoff Hofner bass that the action, I'm sure, was, you know, 4 or 5 inches. You know, and I don't have really strong hands, but I remember I could do it. And I just never wanted to stop. And at that point, you know, my family had to listen to, you know, boom, 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 as they say, of the bass from the basement.
And what state did you grow up in? I don't remember.
I'm from Baltimore, Maryland.
Okay. All right. Home of the crab cakes and the crab.
I'm telling you, you know.
So like, what was the music scene like for you, like, as you were growing into the instrument? Were you playing, like, sessions and gigs all around town, and then you decided to move to L.A.? Tell me what that transition was like.
No, I was just playing with the bands I was in. We had one called Head and West, and then we had one called Tall in the Saddle that actually stayed together for about just until a few years ago, you know. Everybody, but they weren't they weren't professional musicians, but they kept the band going. So I guess around college, you know, when I graduated high school, I was like, okay, so we're going to do this with the band and all. And everybody's like, no, we're going to college. And I'm like, what? And so my goal was to get to California, because at that point I kind of knew, you know, I did okay, you know, at playing and all. And I just felt like I just had to pursue that. So I tried college, three different ones, actually, like a semester at each or a year at each. And then I just got in my van and came to California.
Wow. Well, that must have been an intense drive. Just like, I'm going for it. Like that. Never visited. You just were like, that LA is the place I need to be. And I'm going to just head there.
That's exactly what it was. And I remember I went with a distant cousin who lived in Austin. And I had my van, so he had to go from Maryland down to back to Texas. So I took him down and stopped there and spent a few weeks on his, I don't want to say a ranch, but he had a lot of property out there. A lot of these people, this is 78, so it was kind of post-hippie. They all had 26 acres and people that nobody wore clothes. And it was just like, what, you know? And I was there for a few weeks, and then I came to Santa Monica because I knew somebody who knew somebody. And as soon as I got here, I turned around and went back to Texas. I mean, this is a long drive. And I just said, I missed that. And then I got to Texas. And as soon as I got to Texas, I went, you know, the whole idea is to go to California for music. So I turned around and came back never left again.
And so what was it, startling just coming the first time and just kind of being in this area, or just like feeling out, you know, the music vibes, or what?
Oh, I wasn't there that long. I literally turned around. I came in at night, and I guess whoever I was supposed to see that night wasn't around. And so I said, you know, I had such a great time. Let me go back there. And it wasn't until I went back there that I realized, you know, and then once I came out here, then it was just great. I mean, I was kind of like in heaven. Yeah, the weather is so different than Maryland.
Right. Not as humid and just sunny all the time. And did you start going to like jams, or like did you just network with songwriters? Like, how did you get your first gig, or like, you know, how was that process like?
Well, I remember one of the first gigs I did was playing bass for an 8-year-old Elvis impersonator.
That's awesome.
All the way out in Palmdale. It was like 20. But it's interesting because I did meet somebody who I became friends with forever, even though it wasn't necessarily because of that. John Schwartz, Bermuda Schwartz from Weird Al's band, was on that gig. And we kind of hit it off. But then, you know, life went on. And then fast forward 20 years or whatever. And I ended up on, you know, Weird Al album. And I would see him at some of the gigs I would do. John would play drums with different people at some of the gigs I would do.
Did
so
you play bass on that record with Weird Al Yankovic?
No, I played steel. By then I switched. It was probably 1980 that I switched, right around there.
Let's talk about that, because we kind of touched upon it in our Sight and Sound interview. And you kind of, you know, you said there were a lot of bass players around at the time, and you just felt like you know, you were starting to gravitate towards pedal steel. Who put that pedal steel in front of you? Who was the person that kind of introduced you to the instrument that kind of led you down that rabbit hole?
Well, it was actually me. But that's a great question, because I wish I could figure out, you know, maybe who did. When I was back in Maryland playing bass, I did get a beginner steel. And I had it for about a week. And I remember kind of people saying to me, wait, you're a bass player. You know, it wasn't quite as tolerant as LA with, you know, being a multi-instrumentalist is not an odd thing. But, you know, maybe there or whatever. It was just a little odder, although everybody loved it. And I was playing that kind of music. But I just only had it for a week. And, you know, it didn't connect right then. So I got rid of it. And then when I came out here, like we talked about before, every time I'd sit in with a band playing bass, the bass player would have to sit down. Right. And I just didn't like that, to make them have to sit down and then I'm only playing two songs, whatever. And I thought, what can I do to augment that? I said, well, let me take a look at steel one more time. And instead I got a Dobro, and it clicked to me. Like, I understood it. And
you went back to the action. You went back to the action. That was
the Hofner had worse action. And I think it was, good that I waited to get into it. So when I had it before, you know, back there, it really wasn't that people were like, well, you can't play that. But I guess I was thinking that too, you know,
what's really interesting about that transition too, like, you know, so part of my envy with bass players is like, they only got to worry about one note. They can know like fifths, they can know fourths, they can know like where things, you know, how they operate, but really they only have to think about the lowest note or the bass line or like the groove or whatever, which is the most important part in a band. But it's just like that. They don't have to think about chords, major, minor. Like it, if they play an E and if it's major or minor, it's still going to be.
Well,
you know, unless they do the third, you know what I mean? So.
Well, right. But to me, it's like they should know. I always like working with a bass player who does know. And when I play, I still play a lot of bass on recordings and stuff, for, you know, at my studio for clients and all. And it's good for me to know what any accidentals are. But to me, the fundamental difference is the bass is playing the part right at that moment. Whereas with the steel, I have this couple of nanoseconds to hear what the bass is doing, hear what you're doing on your vocal, your guitar, and then answer it. So they couldn't be more opposite, where one is, you know, like you said, if it's an E, and on beat one, it's an E on beat one.
Right.
And then as a steel player, or, you know, the other instruments I play, you have to process that, you know, and then I call it reacting, you know, and then weaving through everything else.
And did you start learning from recordings, or did you just kind of start experimenting with kind of like swells and just the instrument and the nature of it?
Oh, for steel?
Yeah.
Well, once I started playing dobro, then I had like an idea of how to, what I call, read a tuning. You know, in other words, I like looking. Some players, you know, they play guitar, they look all over the place. I like looking at the neck and seeing what it's going to tell me my next move is. It's just my own thing. And on steel and dobro, you kind of really do that because there's no frets. You
yes.
know, so you have to be somewhat accurate on, or if you're inaccurate, how much inaccurate do you want to be, you know, whatever it is. So when I started playing dobro, it all made sense. It was like the tuning of the neck was just yelling out to me. And then with steel, it made even more sense, because with dobro, you have strings in a bar, but right. you have to slant the bar.
Right.
Whereas with steel, it's like, well, how do I bring that note under my bar instead of having to slant to the note? It's complicated because you have knee levers and pedals, but it all made sense. And the logic of it, I think, made it not daunting for me.
And, you know, with the levers and, you know, like the pedals on the instrument, like, is it all half steps, or do they, like, what's the differentiation between
different strings? Could be a half step up, could be a half step down, it could be a whole step up. You can have raise something a whole step up, but then drop a knee lever to move it a half a step in between that.
Wow.
Or, yeah, it's like I said, it's as if you had a wish list of any notes you want to play, but you only have one finger to play it, so you move them to you. And wow. you have to do it like instantly and then get off of it because you're moving somewhere else.
That's amazing. It's almost like a Rubik's Cube of an instrument, you know. But you kind of got the gist of it. And then do you remember what your first gig or session was when you started playing pedal steel?
I there was a band who let me sit in with them. A guy, I remember, I think he went by Little Tyke. He was a kind of a country singer in the valley up here, you know, somewhere. And he had a three-piece. And he said, oh, you got a steel. And I could get around, this is like within 2 weeks, but I could get around almost playing dobro on it, like right. kind of cheating a little bit here and there. And I think he just wanted the sound of steel, but, you know, he liked me and he saw that I wanted to learn. I wasn't just playing. It was like, wow, every song he played gave me something that I should figure out how to do. And I guess he could see the wheels grinding.
Right.
And so he gave me, you know, and I think he even paid me, you know, so it was, yes. was kind of cool. you know, go figure.
You tune the pedal steel in like in one key, or do you kind of do a standard and a mix? I mean, I assume the dobro must have been in an open tuning of some sort.
Yeah, right? Dobro's in an open G. A lot of people also, you know, add open D. Pedal steel has two necks. Classically, there's the more country neck, or, you know, the furthest out neck when you see two necks. The closest neck is kind of a jazz tuning or a Western swing tuning. It's to a sixth chord. It's like a C6.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. And although I did take that off of my steel and tune my second neck like a lap steel so I could dig in and do some really dirty stuff, because nobody on any sessions I've ever done has ever said, hey, can you play the jazz neck, you know? And so this is kind of like a little secret weapon that when something's missing, I can, you know, crank in a rat or something, you know, nasty and play lap steel on it.
Which and the lap steel tuning is in what? It's a standard key?
My steels are 10 strings. That one's a 6-string E tuning.
Okay.
You know, I don't know how deep we should go by calling out what the tuning is. That's up to you. But it's just I call it bonehead open E, kind of like a David Lindley tuning or just a regular lap steel tuning, 6-string lap okay. steel. So I have 4 tuners that are doing nothing on the neck.
Wow.
And then the main neck, though, the forward neck, is tuned to what we call an E9th chromatic. So it has a flat 7 in it. It has a 2 in it, a couple of 2s, you know, seconds in there. So it's kind of an E tuning. And then the pedals and the knee levers, like the easiest way to say, and it goes way deeper than this, but when you mash the first 2 pedals, you're taking the third of the E tuning up a half a step, and you're taking the fifth up a whole step,
right.
and which then gives you an A tuning.
Right. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
That's wild. Yeah, I don't think I've ever asked you this in all this time that we've been making recordings. I don't think I've ever asked you the tuning about how you have the pedals still. It's amazing.
Well, one day I'll get you behind it.
Yeah, I'd love to see it. You really are a Jedi master of the instrument.
I don't know.
It makes sense. You play with Tom Petty, you play with Bruce Springsteen, Jewel, you Glenn Campbell. We're going to play something first. What do you want to play first? Your choice of the 3 things you sent me.
I don't know. Do you have a thought? How about the Glenn Campbell, so that you can hear the kind of straighter, purer tone, because I think the other songs are going to be a little nastier.
Okay, here's Marty Rifkin with Glenn Campbell.
But first, we'll start with an all-time classic. I love this. Glenn Campbell.
We stopped. Let's try what happened, Sam. Do we not get it? Oh, it says it's not working. You know what? Let's play the Bruce Springsteen. Let's try the Bruce Springsteen one real quick.
Grammy-winning rock and roll legend whose latest album, We Shall Overcome, the Seeger Sessions, terrific album, currently on tour through the end of the month. Please welcome the one, the only Bruce Springsteen and the Seeger Sessions Band.
It's for our friends in New Orleans. Well, a doctor comes round here with his face so bright. Such times and wait. He said, me and my
What a band. What a sound. That was a great solo, too. That was awesome.
Oh, really. Thank you.
So tell me what that, what was the experience or what led to you meeting Bruce and starting to work with him?
I got called to do a session with him, just a short little morning thing up at his place and when he was here in L.A. And I went there that morning, and then we ended up, breaking and then playing again at night, and ended up coming back for like a month.
Wow. Yeah. You must have made an impression.
Well, it was great. It was just a small little group of us. It was, Bruce, we had a drummer in a bedroom in the back, with a Sony camcorder so he could see what was going on. And it was Bruce and I was, he was like right in front of me. I was playing, and then Danny Federici and Gary Talent and a couple different bass players, and that was it.
Wow, well, yeah. that's a legendary group right there, though. So and you guys, you didn't record an analog tape, did you? Or did you do digital? Do you remember?
I think we went to like maybe a Sony digital. I'm trying to remember, maybe like a 3348 or whatever they called that.
Must have been a fan of Bruce before you got the call, obviously. And then were you a little bit nervous? Like, that's a big call. Like, this could be a life-changing call on some level. And it was for you, on some level.
It ended up being. But no, I think I just needed to, make sure, I was going there and doing that because I didn't know. I never talk. First of all, I don't talk about things until the records come out.
Right.
And it was pretty funny because even with Bruce, I was doing a show called The Barn Dance. And at the time we were up at Jack's Sugar Shack up in Hollywood. And I remember, we had worked at Bruce's house. And then that night he said, "Do you have The Barn Dance tonight?" He said, "Yeah." Or maybe I told him or whatever. And he showed up. And so, he even sat in with the band, played guitar, but he was so great to everybody. But of course he and I, were hanging a bunch, and everybody's like, "Why is he hanging with Marty?" Why is he not knowing I had been there that day, right. And a few months later when the record came out, they went, The Ghost of Tom Joad, they went, "Oh,
I know why now."
So I don't count any of my chickens, so to speak. I just, it was great, though. It was a great experience, and it was just pure, It was because we were just playing. He was playing acoustic and singing, and like I said, I was 4 feet in front of him.
Crazy.
It was.
And as a seasoned vet, and you are a seasoned vet, I find it really interesting. You're like, "I'm not going to announce this until it comes out." Did you have experiences in the past where it's like you would tell somebody and then it fell through? Because I've had many things like that, that have happened. So I understand that on a lot of levels.
Well, I really didn't and actually haven't had much of that. But something told me, I think, I had done Wildflowers maybe 6 months before. And I knew not to talk about it. I just, for some reason, felt like, no, this isn't about me bragging or anything. This is what they're doing. And I went on to learn that you don't talk about it because the record, even if it comes out or doesn't come out, it's like you don't want the press going, oh, you know, Marty, Steel Player play, Tom Petty, he must be doing a hardcore country album, which it wasn't, you know. So I've kind of learned that to be good to the artists. And of course, that's also in the more pop or rock world. I remember I did a thing with Dwight and Dwight Yoakam, and I said something about that. Are we allowed to talk about this, or can we talk, you know? And he goes, yeah, everybody knows, you know, let's let the world know. And it was just recording. And that, I think in that world, that's normal, right, you know?
Right.
And
cat out of the bag, so to speak, right?
Well, yeah, you know, to be fair to them. And of course, you don't want to say, hey, there is that other thing, but I didn't really think about it that much. But like, hey, I just recorded with Bruce, but then there's no record.
Right.
You know, but that's a smaller factor than, you know, I just knew not to talk about it. And then I've learned that in general, not to talk about stuff.
You know? Well, you know what I really like, I've been blown away with you about, is you create such a magical vibe, no matter who you're playing with. I mean, it's like when we started
working, well, thank you.
You didn't know my band from any other garage band or anything else. And I just remember, you know, I remember looking at your website. I actually looked at it today. And I just remember seeing all the albums going by and just being like, wow, this guy is just playing on all the most incredible records. He is like an incredible musician. Mm. And when we had a phone conversation, I could just hear it in your voice. I was just like, this guy's very connected, like to himself, to whatever that, you know, universal thing that we love about music is. And then when we worked together in the studio, I just remember you playing like one note. And I was just like, oh, man, like you were just like growing up. And I just remember going,
thank you.
You have such a gift to how you kind of approach music and tone and just like ideas. Like, do you find yourself like, do you kind of, when you're practicing, and this is like a question for me, like when you're practicing, are you kind of like, are there go-tos for you, like as far as ideas, or are you kind of like experimenting and kind of seeing what kind of makes your head, your wheels turn, you know, to ignite the song or add something? What's your process on that side?
I think it's probably more to experience something new or whatever. I don't sit and just play scales over and over, and I don't necessarily play licks over and over, although, you know, like any player, you probably hear, oh, I remember doing, you know, and I did that there, you know, whatever. But my goal with Steel, and if we're only talking about Steel, my goal is for it to be fluid, really fluid, and not like just a bag of Rolodex licks.
Right.
To hear everything, and maybe because I've worked in production so much, to hear everything going on, and once again, to react to it with whatever that dynamic or that one note. Once I heard your stuff, it was like, okay, you know, it needs this maybe. The other thing is to, which I learned years and years ago, is we don't know quite what our musical voice is, but right, we know that we should follow it, because if somebody hires you to play on something, and you're in a different situation because you're an artist, you know, so, but you have to have your voice. So if somebody says, Nikki, I want you to sing, you can't say, well, they had so-and-so sing on the last record who has a different voice than mine, so let me change my voice to match that person.
Right.
No, you bring your voice. And as a musician, that's what I learned, is to let everything go and just play what I'm hearing and what I'm feeling and what I think maybe should be there, and keep it as smooth and fluid as possible. And if they want something different, okay, then switch it. You know, that's fine. As opposed to, how would so-and-so play this? Or look at me and my instrument.
Right.
You know?
That's the thing I'm thinking about. It's like, you play with a very high level of restraint, and it just always sounds like everything's the right note, group of notes, phrases. And it's like, you always give just the right amount of whatever it needs. And that's a really hard place. Like, even when I do guitar solos on a record, I always tell the engineer, I need three takes to just let me play the most noodliest, you know, bullshit, you know, that I can play to get it out of my system. And then I was like, okay, now I'm ready to make some music. So like, I need to get that out of me because like I the excitement of like, oh, I'm going to play a guitar solo. But like, you're just like ready at the helm to just, you know, deliver this perfect level of restraint. And it's like, I know that, you know, maybe artists are like, hey, you know, you can do this and that, and then you'll change some of that dynamic, but it still has this sure. perfect level of restraint where it's like, I know you can give way more than you do. And that is a real big sign of like how great you are, because you're like,
you're
not going to see all my tricks in this song.
No. You're going to get
exactly what the song needs. And that is an approach that a lot of people don't always use. So, you know, that must have been something you kind of took up the philosophy of. Or did you maybe are you just listening to songs, or were there songs that you listened to before, you know, that made you, you know, love music, that you were like, I want to emulate what these players are doing? Like, who are some of the biggest influences for you as a player?
Well, even trying to emulate somebody, I wouldn't learn what they do. And because I was too busy working, to be honest with you. Like when I first started playing steel, I was also working during the day at McCabe's guitar shop here in Santa Monica. And at night I'd be playing clubs. And eventually I went from that little three piece that I told you about to having a handle on the instrument and working with everybody in LA. And then everything got, you know, there were that urban cowboy scene kind of hit in the early 80s. And so I was working with everybody. And then eventually I moved away from just country, you know, but that was even more pop country. So that was good. Because I didn't sit down with records and learn these licks, because I didn't do it as a kid. I did it as an adult. If I wanted to sound like them early on, I would do my impression of what I think they're doing without listening to what they're doing.
Oh, interesting.
You know, and it was fake, you know? So I think if I was to listen to something from back then and compare it to what I thought it was going to be, with somebody else, it would be so different. And I think then eventually I kind of got rid of that, because, you know, you just go into what you're doing.
Well, and it's also you were finding your voice. You're like, that's me trying to be something else. This is what I love. I want to make something like this and sound like this. So it makes sense, mm-hmm. because you kind of have to go through that to get to that place. So that's a relief for me to hear you say that, because I mean, really, it's always like a pleasure making music with you. And when I hear you play, it's always
always
so beautiful. It's just like it's kind of refreshing to know that you had to go from, you know, someplace to get to there. You know,
oh, you have to, and then you start. I couldn't see any other way not to. You know, I mean, there's a million ways to get to where you can end up. Whether it's lessons, whether it's sitting with an album over, I used to do that on bass, you know, just put the needle down and try to learn anything. So there's just different methods, but I can't imagine like sitting down to an instrument and then there's your voice, unless you're already a seasoned musician. And then you find, well, there's similarities, you know, when I play mandolin, I also play with a lot of slides. I like that, you know, kind of a thing. And that's probably from, you know, playing steel.
Well, let's play something else. Let's play the Ocean Song. Tell me a little bit about this track and who the artist is.
Okay, so this is a group called Fastball. They're still around. They're great. They had a hit called The Way, and then Must Have Been Out of My Head. You know, it was a great one. And I had played on their record, and it was the end of the session. I played pedal steel, but I had taken my old 1954 double neck lap steel, like, you know, Fender, this thing that's normally on four legs, you know, and all that. And they said something about the song. They said, well, we're looking for something. And Billy Preston had played keyboards on it.
Wow.
So you'll hear his influence. It's a lot of that keyboard. And a really fun song. And so I said, you know, I have an idea. I pulled out that lap steel, and I think I pulled out like that rat pedal I was telling you about. And we cranked up, I think the amp, it might have been a twin or something. And I remember we turned it to 10 because I thought, well, that's going to be the end of that amp. You know, this might have been, I'm not sure where, but, you know, I knew the studio could handle it, maybe Henson or something like that. And And I knew when I heard it, and they were talking little bits about melody, you know, at the beginning of it or whatever. And then I thought, well, I have to make it sound like I'm not overdubbing. I have to make it sound like these guys are playing to me, even though I'm overdubbing it. They had probably already recorded it a week ahead of time. And kind of just dug in. And I remember because of the key, I even put a capo on at one point, you know, for it, which is odd on a lap steel.
Right.
And
must have been one hell of a capo.
And, right. They kind of hang. It would have worked on the Hofner bass. They ended up with two solos. Like there's one in the middle and then there's, you know, one at the end. And it's on the radio. In fact, I'll go to a grocery store and I hear this song all the time. It's still being played like that. You know?
That's when you kind of know you made it, when you hear something you've done in the in Target or in some grocery store. And that's pretty wild.
Yeah. That, and then after the song, I could tell you another way that I knew I had made it, which had something to do with my kids.
All right. Well, let's hear. Here's Fastball on Marty Rifkin. Here we go.
In my heart, in your trembling hands, I said, rise to meet me halfway up among the stars. You may be from Venus, but I'm definitely not from Mars. You're an ocean, settle down, what's the commotion? I'm an island, but you're an ocean. Stormy sea of love and emotion. You got me suspended motion, rest inside. Make the warm wind circle around my head just like it do. If I could do it, I'd be doing it to you. I believe I'd buy whatever you would sell to me. Never came with a guarantee. You're an ocean, settle down, what's a commotion? I'm an island, but you're an ocean. It's a stormy sea of love and emotion. You got me suspended motionless in time. Sell to me. Nothing in my life ever came with a guarantee. You're an ocean, settle down, what's the commotion? I'm an island, but you're an ocean. It's a stormy sea of love and emotion. You got me suspended motionless. You got me suspended motionless.
You know, it's cool because, like, I've always heard that song and known that song. Knowing you were playing it, it brought out the solos in a different way. Just like listening to it, it's like the solos were always part of the hook and the song and the whole production. But it's like knowing that you played it, it was like, man, you hear the fire in a different way. It's really
oh, thank you.
Two solos. Both solos were killer.
It was fun, and that was with a completely different tuning too. That was like an A6 tuning or something. And
it sounds great. It's like it's got the sheen to it and an overdrive sound that you don't really hear all the time on a recording. So
no.
It was great. It was really awesome.
And it was fun.
Did you get to meet Billy Preston during the recording?
No, he had already been recorded. That was already on tape.
That would have been cool.
That would have been very cool.
But you're still on the recording with him. So
that's fine. I'll take it.
Well, tell me what you were saying. You said there's a story about making it with your kids.
Oh, so it's funny. At the time, they were, I want to say maybe 10 and 12. I have two boys that are, you know, much older now. And I remember I played on all these other albums, and you know, they had some notoriety and all that kind of stuff, and they were like, well, it's just dad, that's dad. So one day I come home and I go, so fellas, guess who I hung with tonight? I said, who? I said, Weird Al Yankovic. They went, Weird Al? I said, yeah. He goes, you and Weird Al? And at that point I had total street cred, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah. You know? So everything shifted at that point.
That's you know what's funny is like every professional musician or celebrity musician, they say the same thing. Like they could be the greatest in the world, and their kids are just like, oh, come on, dad. You know, like. But then there's some affiliation with an artist they love. Once you reach that crossroads with that artist, they're like, oh my God, I see you all the work.
Exactly. And then I ended up playing another thing for him a few years later on another record. But he was just great. He was so musical. And I remember that, you know, we had a great time. And it was probably, 2 days later that they're like, yeah, it's just that. But at least I had a little time.
You had that moment. You're like, I was cool with them at one point.
Right. And now they get it. So that's good. Right. You know, my youngest son does music. He's an artist, kind of goes by Pink Sock. And my other one plays music, even though he's not a professional musician.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Well, yeah, Sam,
he's in the tech world.
The Glenn Campbell song is ready, but tell us, give us a little kind of like warm up or kind of like a lead in for this.
I played on, actually it was the same producer, Julian Raymond, produced Glenn Campbell's kind of comeback. It was called Meet Glenn Campbell. And I ended up playing on that. And I love Glenn. He was just hitting the Alzheimer's. He was going through that. I don't know if you recall that. And it was kind of really touching, but I'm such a fan of like all the old stuff, you know, and Wrecking Crew stuff and whatever. So I could talk to Glenn about stuff like that, and he could remember it like it was yesterday.
Wow.
So it was kind of great. And then he had a regular touring band, and myself and sometimes another great keyboard player, Kim Bullard, and a couple different people end up playing with them on certain things like TV. And, you know, we went back and did the Jules Holland show in England and that kind of stuff.
Awesome.
Kind of augmented the band. So he was on the Chris Isaak show, and we ended up doing this, you know, with Chris, and we blended both bands.
That's amazing. Well, here's Glenn Campbell with Marty Ripkin.
But first, we'll start with an all-time.
Oh, what happened? Let's try it again, Sam. Oh, so he says it's not working. Oh, well, that's weird. All right. Well, we'll see if we can try it again in a bit. But tell me, like, what that experience was like when you were kind of, like, working with Glenn. And he was suffering a little bit from the Alzheimer's. So, you know, tell me, that must have been a little bit of an obstacle, right?
It was a bit, which is crazy, because once he started playing, he was just like, boom, right there. You know what I mean? And once everybody found out about it, this pouring of love came out, and everybody was, you know, kind of relating it to their own families and who they, you know, might know. So it was kind of touching to be around it when it was happening. And he was just really nice and really awesome. And his family, his wife, Kim, and his kids played with him. And, I just really enjoyed it, because I grew up, you know, a huge fan, and I was a kid. I would watch his TV show you know, religiously. And then, you know, it's one of those, you know, he's singing like Wichita Lineman. You know, I close my eyes and I hear him. I open my eyes and there he is.
Wow. But, you know, I mean, it's like he's one of the legends, especially of, like, you know, country and Western and just kind of also crossing over to that pop thing. And, you know, you kind of made music with him at a time where he probably, that was like the sense memory experience that kind of maybe centered him the most, you know? So it's kind of sure. Like a pretty powerful experience that you got to have that, you know, moment with him. And, you know, tell me what's next for you. Are you always working on, you know, live performance, more studio stuff? I know you're producing artists.
I'm definitely more studio. I'm not doing tons of live, but something I'll get called for something when I least expect it. My studio schedule's pretty slammed between, you know, regular sessions, and then I do produce a lot of artists at my studio. I've been here for, you know, forever here in Santa Monica, the old Beach Boys rehearsal studios and stuff.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's awesome.
Yeah. And so I'm working with just fantastic people, but I'll get a call and I'll just go, oh, you know, I wasn't expecting that. Like recently I was on The Voice, but I didn't get the call till like 2 days before I was supposed to be there. So I don't know what's ahead of me.
Right.
You know, I'm curious what might be ahead of me.
You said you liked, we were talking about that earlier. It's like, you said you kind of enjoy the unknown a little bit. So tell me, like, you know, I always find it, you know, that like, it's the same thing. It's like, I never know what's around the corner, and that's what makes it exciting.
I also don't know
what's around the corner, and that makes it aggravating. So tell me how you got to the place of just being like, you know, it works, you know?
Well, fortunately, I'm always working. So I don't have that big, huge downtime of waiting for something else.
Right.
You know, it's just a constant, if anything, I usually have to move something to accommodate the next thing. And I know that that's a position that it's an honor for me to hold that position. I know it's not a normal position, you know, to be able to say that you're working all the time. But for some reason, I never have that kind of that moment of, wow, you know, when's the phone going to ring? And but I can relate to it because I know it's hard, you know, for people.
Well, what's funny is that just like creating a song over silence, like out of nowhere, you know, that's like how the music path can be. Like, you know, when I look back at my path, it's like sometimes I get a call or an email to play a major festival, or it's opening for a major artist, or it's a huge venue that I've wanted to play in or have.
Right.
You know, like whatever. And it's like, it's you kind of have to stay grounded through even the highest of the highs, because you know there are going to be some lows on this journey at some point. So I try never to get too excited until after it's finished. And then it's like, oh, cool, this is what I've done. How do you stay grounded as a musician that can, you know, do these epic, you know, sessions with these legends and then come back and just like, you're like ready to do the next thing. Like, is there any kind of transition, or do you just kind of like see all the gigs as it's a gig that I get to do what I do, and that's what is the most fortunate part of it?
Yeah, that's what it is. I can work with somebody who, you know, we all love and adore. And then the next day it could be somebody who's working on their first thing, you know, that we're working together. It's a different experience because, you know, one you might have to mentor and the other one you're, you know, in there doing your thing and playing for them, for the other, you know, the artist. I don't know if that explains it well, but to me, it's just the work. It's not like I do a session and then come back and the next day, like just live in that session if I have to work the next day.
Right. You're ready to deliver the goods for the next session, and just like, don't, you know, hang anything on that great session that you just did the night before. You just kind of like stay even keel.
Hey, I try to. And that's one of the things about not talking about a record till it's out, because once the records come out, it's already been so long since you did the session.
Right.
That, it's not like the only thing that's boiling in your life. And, you know, and even when I worked with Bruce up at his house, I mean, it was, you know, there, the next day I might have been back here at my place. And I remember I had we had a mix a thing, and it was a special thing. And Bruce was like, yeah, let's take the day off. You go do your thing, you know? And it wasn't like, well, but you know, yesterday I did that. Yeah. Right, it's never like that. You're there to play music and.
Well, it's also, what's cool is like you're playing music and you're playing on these big records and these big songs, and then you don't hear them, like you said, for 6 months. Do you ever kind of like step back and like, when's your moment to kind of like listen and go, oh yeah, this is cool. I remember this. They used that part that I love. I'm glad. Like, when is that moment for you?
Well, first, for it to come out, I usually remember with the session, there's things that happen. You know, usually there's little marquee moments. Tom Petty stuff was, you know, Rick Rubin saying, hey, the first part of the song, I said, you know, when it goes to the four chord, what do you want me to do? And he's like, well, I don't know from that. First part of the song, start here. When it gets exciting, go up. You know, so I'll remember that. And then I'll hear what's happening. And so.
Yeah, I remember that direction.
Yeah.
Well, Marty, you've been a wonderful guest. You were the second guest on Sight and Sound. And, you know, we actually got the most followers and subscriptions and views for our episode that we did together. So I wanted to thank you for being a guest on Sight and Sound, and thank you for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. And where can people find you online if they want to find you for sessions and whatnot?
MartyRifkin.com. You know, you see by the website, I don't really sell myself much. You know, it's just a few albums.
Work, yeah.
You know, I don't. But yeah, it's the best way to reach me. You know, I'm so easy to find. And I have to tell you, Nikki, you are so awesome.
Thank you.
Playing with you is my happy place. I'm just glad that all of your endeavors here, getting music out to people and the different musicians that you showcase, it's just a wonderful thing. And it's so great for the listeners to learn people and what you're doing.
I really admire you. I really admire your musicianship. You and I are always going to make records. We are always going to be, you know, making music together. And I just want to thank you for, you know, just bringing that to my albums and my music and my band, because I just really revere and respect you so much. So thank you so much, Marty.
Always. You can count on me.
On behalf of Marty, Sam, and myself, we'll see you guys next week. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Peace and love.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.